Hello, I'm Claire Catford with Guardian Daily on Tuesday the 10th of February. On the way, Australian wildfires continue to blaze, causing further devastation.
The flames and the fires were coming in at such a rate of knots that there really was nothing that people could do unless they'd fled the day before.
Political prisoners tortured by Mugabe's regime all should have been released before the power-sharing government is sworn in tomorrow. And nurseries or your grandparents, which is best for your child? First, Sandy Waugh with the news headlines and the papers.
Australian police have declared as crime scenes the towns devastated by continuing bushfires. At least 173 people are dead and more than 5,000 homeless as firefighters continue to battle fires north of Melbourne. Police indicated last night they were closing in on suspected arsonists, believed to be responsible for lighting some of the 400 fires in the states of Victoria and New South Wales. There's more to come from our correspondent on the scene in the Yarra Valley later in the programme. The government minister Ed Balls, a key adviser to Gordon Brown when he was Chancellor, has said the world is facing the most serious recession for 100 years. Mr Balls made the claim, the strongest so far from a member of the government, to Labour activists in Yorkshire. The comments threaten to overshadow plans being considered by the government to cap bonuses payable to Royal Bank of Scotland bankers at £25,000. Meanwhile, former RBS Chief Sir Fred Goodwin has been called in to explain his bank's actions at the Treasury Select Committee later today. Follow that as it happens at guardian.co.uk/business. A winter storm is continuing to batter much of England and Wales this morning. Heavy snow and rain is causing flooding and power cuts across the country. Forecasters say some areas recorded their monthly average rainfall for February in just 24 hours. Meanwhile, a band of snow stretching from South Wales into the Midlands left up to 3,000 homes without electricity in Gloucestershire, Worcestershire and Herefordshire. Many herbal medicines and other complementary therapies do nothing to help people with rheumatoid arthritis, according to a report published today. Nearly 60% of people with arthritis are believed to use alternative medicines, and Britons spend more than £450 million on them each year. But the report, compiled by the Arthritis Research Campaign, found most were completely ineffective or had only tentative evidence to suggest they worked. In football, Chelsea have sacked their coach, Luis Felipe Scolari, after just 5 months in the job. The Brazilian World Cup winners paid the price for Chelsea's poor form in the Premier League, and his departure comes after fans called for his dismissal at the weekend's 0-0 draw with strugglers Hull. Frank Rijkaard and Gus Hiddink are the two favourites to replace Scolari, with Chelsea still chasing three trophies this season. Now for a look at today's papers, and the front page is packed with that news of the Chelsea coach's sacking. Big fail, Scolari, says The Sun, while The Mirror claims the blow will be dampened by a £7.5 million payoff. The other dominant story is the bankers' bonuses. The Mail reports the chief executive of RBS can expect a £4 million payoff if he's sacked in what the paper calls a reward for failure. An editorial in the FT, meanwhile, calls for the government to end the bonus culture but keep bonuses where appropriate. A report in the Telegraph claims millions of healthy people will be put on cholesterol-lowering drug. A new report says the drugs are more effective than previously thought. A poll in the Times shows Labour at its lowest rating in 6 months. It dropped 5 points to 28%, while the Tories drop 1 point to 42%. And the front page of the Express shows rubbish piled up on a street following a disruption of bin collection by the bad weather. The same story in the Telegraph claims that rubbish has attracted a large increase in rats. And there's more news in sport, plus up-to-the-minute weather reports at guardian.co.uk.
The number of deaths from wildfires in the Australian state of Victoria is set to rise, according to officials. More than 140 lives have already been lost. Police believe that some of the fires were started deliberately, actions which the Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, said amounted to mass murder. The Guardian's James Smith describes the scene.
The scene is a lot of carnage, really, in places. As you enter Yarra Valley, a lot of it seems to be untouched, and then suddenly it hits you. You'll see these vast swathes of just destroyed fields and burnt trees. If you head in some of the worst areas, you'll just see just streets wiped out where flames have just come tearing through the forest, and some houses are like, they're just rubble, corrugated iron, there's burnt out cars all over the place. There'll be such a fine line sometimes that you have another house next door that has been completely untouched, It's quite incredible how the damage in some ways is widespread, but in some ways is very localised.
There have been some very moving stories that have emerged from this, survivors recounting how they have fled walls of flames. What have people told you?
I've met one chap who was driving back. He got a phone call from his sister. He was out in town, who told him that there was this raging wall of fire coming through the forest at a speed that people couldn't outrun it. But he wanted to come back and try and save his house, so he drove back up into the hills. And as he was driving down this little sort of dirt track with flames on either side, a tree fell in front of him on the road, blocking the road. He was forced to get out, douse himself in water from a nearby barrel, and then sort of cover his face and walk the last kilometre to his house. He said there was burning limbs falling from trees around him. His house was starting to catch on fire, and he was able to put it out.
The wildfires have already claimed 135 lives. Presumably that number is rising.
Yeah, it's been going up. I think it will still rise. I think that there are certain communities that either haven't been reached yet or there hasn't been the time to actually go through properties. People I've spoken to today know of people who are dead. They also say that there are a number of people they know that are missing. I think to try and cut down on that now, they've got these emergency relief centres where if people do decide to evacuate their homes, then they've been asked to go there first and register their details. So if there are any concerned friends or relatives, they can find out. But there wasn't time to do that on Saturday. I mean, people knew it was going to be bad, but it just came in so quickly, like you were saying before. The flames and the fires were coming in at such a rate of knots that there really was nothing that people could do unless they'd fled the day before.
Police believe that some of the fires were started deliberately, and the Prime Minister, as you know, has said that this amounts to mass murder. What's been the reaction, and at what stage is the investigation at now? I guess it's just begun.
There are claims that they have information and they are sort of closing their net, so to speak, on a suspected arsonist. But I mean, they are treating a lot of the fire scenes as crime scenes now, and there's not really a lot of anger necessarily coming out. I think people just can't believe it and they can't really process it. And in fact, I would say in a lot of the cases, people just seem to be remarkably calm. Probably part of the reason they're calm is because they know it's not over. And I was just speaking to the CFA just before, and they believe it could be days or weeks before this is sorted out.
That was James Smith reporting from Melbourne. And we've got more on that ongoing story at guardian.co.uk/Australia. Also on The Guardian's website today, the latest reports from the Israeli elections as it happens tonight. That's at guardian.co.uk/Israel. The sacking of Chelsea's World Cup winning coach, Luis Felipe Scolari. That's at guardian.co.uk/sport. And the fishy-sounding plan to convert passengers' breath into usable biofuel. Find that at guardian.co.uk/environment/blog. President Robert Mugabe's regime has reneged on an agreement to release dozens of opposition activists before tomorrow's swearing-in of a power-sharing government in Zimbabwe. The Guardian has seen doctor's affidavits which reveal that at least 30 of the political and human rights activists held by the state have been tortured. The Guardian's African correspondent, Chris McGreal, is in Harare.
Robert Mugabe's regime had made a commitment through its party to release dozens of opposition activists and human rights activists who've been held in jail for months, at least 30 of them, and very severely tortured in order to extract confessions from them that they were part of a terrorist plot to overthrow the Mugabe government. The deal that was struck between the government and the opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, was that these people would be released in the past few days, with some of them appearing today to be released ahead of Morgan Tsvangirai, the opposition leader, being sworn in as Prime Minister Wednesday. That hasn't happened. They didn't appear in court today. That was apparently because of the intervention of a very senior member of Mugabe's regime, a member of his security cabinet, the prisons commissioner, Major General Peradze Simondi, who refused to hand them over. And this seems to be an indication that there are some hard-line, very senior people around Mugabe who intend to continue to play hardball with the opposition.
So what you're saying is that severe torture techniques were used on these people?
Yes, there's various affidavits sworn out by doctors who were able to get into the maximum security prison in Harare and see 9 of the prisoners, all men. And they described simulated drowning, being hung by their wrists in handcuffs and beaten, being hit with high-voltage electric shocks. There's a particularly shocking case in which a 72-year-old NDC activist was held in a deep freeze until he was nearly frozen, hauled out, stripped naked, and then scalding water was poured on his genitals. Another political activist was hung upside down from a tree and dumped into a water-filled drum until he passed out from simulated drowning. This seems to have been widespread and consistent in order to obtain false confessions that they were members of some kind of terrorist plot against Robert Mugabe.
To what extent, then, will this discovery mean that the transition to the power-sharing government will stall? I mean, that's a possibility once something like this emerges, isn't it?
Well, Morgan Tsvangirai had said back in December that he would not join the power-sharing government whilst these people were still being held. Human rights groups in the past couple of days have called on him to stick by that pledge, but the NDC's line today is that he will go ahead, become prime minister on Wednesday. He will join the government. The opposition now says that they feel that that is the best way of extracting these people from prison, is to get into positions of authority and use particularly their shared control of the Home Affairs to try and get these activists released. But there are certainly those within the opposition and amongst human rights and civic activists who feel that Tsvangirai is backtracking on his commitment, and they take a very bad sign.
That was Chris McGreal, The Guardian's African correspondent. I'm Claire Catford. Still to come, anger grows as RBS bankers are still set to receive a £1 billion bonus payout.
They genuinely believe that bonus culture played a part in creating excessive risk-taking.
But first, the second in our series of daily essays in conjunction with Comment is Free and the Humanist Society of Scotland. Another thought for the day is our secular take on Radio 4's religious message. Today, the broadcaster, author and journalist Muriel Gray questions the view that it's only those who have a religious faith who oppose assisted suicide.
The respected MSP Margot MacDonald has proposed a bill concerning assisted suicide. If passed, it would allow people with degenerative, irreversible conditions, including those as young as 12, the right to request a specially registered doctor to help terminate their lives. Now, Ms. MacDonald has been prompted to this by the sad circumstances of her own condition, suffering as she does from Parkinson's disease. She stated that when her illness progresses to a point of unbearable suffering, she wishes to be permitted to end her life at the time of her choosing with what she considers to be dignity. Now, I have nothing but sympathy and admiration for Margot MacDonald, but I fundamentally oppose her bill. The debate has been portrayed in the press as if it were only between the religious opposing assisted suicide and atheists for it. This is simplistic. I'm an atheist. My morals are based on the fact that there is no evidence of any kind to suggest an afterlife, but a great deal of evidence proving that we're part of a life cycle that's been continuing for millions of years, unique only in that humans have evolved an intelligence allowing us to comprehend the ephemeral nature of our existence. It's this knowledge that drives many to believe in equality, in kindness instead of cruelty, to help alleviate suffering and to try and make the most for everyone of this tiny sliver of consciousness in the infinity of time. And it's also this certain knowledge of death as an end that informs us that life is a most precious phenomenon and should be preserved whenever possible. I don't wish to live in a society pressurising me to take my own life should I begin to suffer. I want to be able to cry out, I want to die, but not mean it. I don't wish to be regarded as selfish, a burden on my relatives should I fall into their care. Neither do I wish to deprive my family of the opportunity to care for me, an honour I've cherished when nursing people I've loved and lost. When in pain or distress, I will crave comfort and love, not execution. We desperately require more support and respect for carers and more effective and accessible pain-controlling palliative treatments. Then all can die with dignity, and none can be accused of being selfish or cowards for wishing to cling to every moment, good or terrible, of this amazing and improbable thing called life.
Muriel Gray with her secular thought for the day, one of a series of 10 thoughts you can hear over the next 2 weeks.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
Bankers should consider waiving their rights to bonuses, according to the Prime Minister Gordon Brown. This comes following the news that the RBS group, saved by taxpayers, is to pay out £1 billion to some banking staff. I asked The Guardian's business reporter, Dan Roberts, what the government could do to stop the payouts.
Well, there's a range of measures they can do. In many cases, the government owns the majority stake in the banks involved, so it's the largest shareholder. It can force for a shareholder resolution. The government of the day, it can pass primary legislation. It could also argue the toss in court. It could ask the banks to stop paying these bonuses, and if the particular bankers decide to challenge that in court, then we can see whether they have a case when it comes to tribunal or court hearings. So the fact of the matter is that many governments have taken quite bold steps on this. Obama has implemented a $250,000 cap. President Sarkozy in France has said they won't be paying bonuses at all. So an awful lot that governments can do, actually.
What is the city saying about whether these bonuses should be paid? Because there is a school of thought that says, well, this applies to the past, it's not the future, therefore they should get what they deserve because you've got to keep the best people.
I think there's a difference between what the city is saying collectively and what individual bankers are saying when it applies to them, which is always the way. Most business people I've spoken to, including senior people in the city, are appalled at what's gone on. They're appalled at the credit crisis. They genuinely believe that bonus culture played a part in creating excessive risk-taking. Lloyd Blankfein, who's the chief executive of Goldman Sachs, who's the sort of the banker's banker, wrote an article in the FT on Monday actually talking about all the things that had gone wrong. So most people in the city accept this needs to be fixed. When it comes to their own bonus and their own paycheck, then obviously people are a little bit more protective, as you would be.
How likely is it, though, that we're going to see a real decision by the government? I know the news is moving on all the time. You've got the opposition saying that the government is too soft on the bankers, they need to take tougher measures and so on and so forth.
I think the government will have to move more on this. They're edging towards it. They've got a very difficult sales job over the next year or two to persuade people to accept some very, very tough medicine. The economy is in its direst straits for decades. People are going to have to accept a lot of pain and hardship. It's going to be difficult to sell that to people if the electorate thinks that others are not sharing that pain equally. And that's why I think this is so important. It's not about envy or greed or the morals of it, but it's the fact that the government needs to take the electorate with it through a very, very difficult economic time.
Ultimately, it's a £1 billion payout if it goes ahead, and that just does not sit well with the fact that you and I, have bailed this bank out in the first place.
Well, that's in the case of RBS, they're thought to have about £1 billion in bonus pool. Yeah, we've spent getting close to £20 billion on that one bank, and it does stick in the throat. RBS would argue that a lot of that money was tied up with its acquisition of ABN AMRO and therefore was in guaranteed bonuses it can't get out of. But a certain proportion of it was discretionary as well. And they're also arguing that they need to carry on paying bonuses to the profitable bits of the bank. Now, in many other organisations, it would be kind of weird if one department was doing really well. The rest of the company went down, but that department still decided it needed to pay itself a bonus. But in banking, there's been these sort of very tribal parts of the organisation that they're a bit of a law unto themselves, and they all think, well, we've had a good year, why should we suffer?
Dan Roberts, The Guardian's business reporter. Now, if you're a working parent, you may rely on your parents to give you a hand with your children. The good news is grandparents can help to boost a baby's vocabulary. However, they may struggle to provide other educational and social experiences infants need. That's according to research by the Institute of Education that also reveals that children in nurseries have better social skills but scored lower in vocabulary tests. I asked The Guardian's education reporter, Anthea Lipsett, whether this meant more for an anxious parent to get concerned about.
No, I don't think so. There are pluses and minuses from both systems. Nurseries are a very good option as far as school readiness and cognitive development goes, but it's not all about schools and how you're going to perform in them in school tests. Grandparents are very good, are in fact the best form of childcare in terms of developing a child's vocabulary.
It says that grandparents score significantly higher in vocabulary tests, but less high when it comes to sociability, and it's the reverse for the nurseries.
Mm-hmm, exactly. The problem that the research uncovers for grandparents doing childcare is that they tend to be slightly more isolated. They're possibly older, so less likely to take the children on trips to the park so that they're socialising with other children, and they're just not getting the same level of interaction with their peers as children that are in a nursery or creche setting would get.
The research has also urged the politicians to give greater support and training to grandparents, and I suppose this applies overall to all carers in whatever context.
Well, this is it. And grandparents can register as child minors and would get all sorts of training and qualifications as a result. But that would mean that they'd have to take on other children that they don't necessarily want to do. So what the researchers are really urging is for the government to give training, flexible training to grandparents and child carers that aren't conventional formal settings.
2 million or nearly 2 million families use grandparents. They are an essential resource for so many families in this country. Should they just continue to be content with what's going on now, or should they worry about the child's social skills and work to try and change that in some way?
There's some issue with grandparents not being involved enough in the children's centres that the government's done quite a lot to set up. So they perhaps need to reach out a little bit more to grandparents. But no, I think grandparents are a real boon for parents that are working, and often they see grandparents as the next best thing to them looking after the child for themselves. And even with this research, I'm sure that won't change parents' perceptions of how their child is brought up. They want the grandparents'
involved in
involvement
the whole thing.
And love and care and support of their child.
And you make a good point there, because it's very difficult to put a value on that love, on that support and on that care that grandparents give, because it's not something that you can measure in government statistics, is it?
No, it's not. The report doesn't obviously measure that. It's more cognitive development and educational outcomes, which are easier to measure than the love and support a grandparent will give a child that falls over and bumps his head and gets smothered in kisses by the grandparent in a way that it wouldn't by a childminder or a nursery or a creche.
But the smother and kisses bit, I'm sure that's important.
Yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
Grey squirrels, it seems, are going to get their comeuppance. Well, they are in Scotland. A widespread cull is planned. It's part of a long-term campaign to control numbers throughout the UK. The aim is to protect the rarer red squirrels from eventual extinction. The Guardian's Scotland correspondent, Severin Carroll, told me more about the scale of the cull.
They're going to be basically drawing this, in my own words, a kind of killing line from the North Sea on the east coast of Scotland near Montrose all the way across to the west coast in Argyll. It's effectively a line along the southern borders of the Scottish Highlands, and any grey squirrel they can find north of that, particularly in the Grampian area around Aberdeen, is going to be trapped and then humanely killed.
Now, there are 3.3 million greys and 160,000 reds. Why are the greys so numerous and the reds so small in comparison?
Well, the greys are just larger and tougher and fitter. They're more adaptable. They have stronger appetites, and they're much more able to live in many, many different kinds of environments. I mean, we'll see grey squirrels in the middle of Britain's biggest cities. They live in the middle of London, live in the middle of Edinburgh. Red squirrels simply can't do that. They're much shyer and smaller. They need a particular kind of habitat, a traditional old British woodland, traditionally. And also the greys carry a squirrel pox, which they're effectively immune to, but is pretty much always fatal for reds. So against that very strong competitor, the reds are finding it incredibly difficult to compete and survive.
So if the greys weren't culled, what would be the likely impact in the future?
Well, the naturalists involved in this new programme beginning today believe quite genuinely that the UK has roughly 30 years in which to prevent the reds disappearing entirely. They're also quite worried that if the programme that they're now beginning in the north of Scotland doesn't take hold, and, you know, if £1.3 million is spent to try and protect reds in the Highlands, and if that doesn't work, then the public are going to start saying, well, we're just going to have to wash our hands of the reds. We can't spend millions and millions of pounds trying to protect them. We're just going to have to let nature take its course.
Is there any opposition to this culling at all?
There's an Edinburgh-based organisation called Advocates for Animals, so Scotland's main kind of animal rights campaign organisation, who are quite angry about this and have just recently released an opinion poll of Scots claiming that 54% of all adults in Scotland actually oppose this cull. They say that the grey's only crime is surviving in its environment, and they believe what the Scottish Natural Heritage, the government and Scottish Wildlife Trust ought to be doing is trying to develop a squirrel pox vaccine, or making and defending the kinds of woodland habitats that red squirrels really need. The difficulty is that the naturalists involved say that the vaccine could take up to a decade to produce, and creating and protecting these kinds of forests will take another decade. So utterly unrealistic, they say. They have to, with deepest reluctance, try and kill as many grey squirrels as they can possibly find in the north of Scotland.
And without getting too sentimental about it, how are they going to kill the grey squirrels? Will they come to a quick end?
Well, they obviously believe that they will. I mean, what's going to be happening is they're going to be placing specially designed traps along these river corridors, the main rivers going up from the central lowlands of Scotland up into the highlands. And when the squirrels are found in these boxes, they're going to be taken out and humanely killed, inverted commas, with a tap to the back of the head. In some cases, they're going to be private landowners going to be out there shooting them with their shotguns, because many landowners, particularly in rural areas of northern England and Scotland, quite regularly go out and kill grey squirrels, which they regard as a pest. The greys also destroy up to £10 million worth of timber every year.
Severin Carroll, reporting from Scotland. Well, that's it from Guardian Daily today. The producers were Ian Chambers and Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Catford. Thank you for listening.